I don't know about you, but every Sunday I get a little message. This week, the message said, your screen time is down 27% from last week. Should I feel proud when it says it's gone down? I feel a bit sheepish when it tells me that my screen time has gone up. But I honestly feel pressures in both directions around this particular bit of technology. I mean, I feel like I shouldn't be on my phone so much. And I also feel like maybe I should be making TikTok videos. I should spend more time outdoors, or, you know, I should really spend more time reading and watching the news. I don't know. Even if I do go outdoors, my cell phone's in my pocket. And if it's a new place that I'm going to walk, I probably use the GPS to get there. These devices are our constant companions now. This technology is always with us. It's shaping our lives. The poem we just heard, with the great title, My Son Calls Me While I'm in Line at the Stop and Shop, dramatizes the most obvious way that cell phones have changed things. We're always reachable. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The parent in the poem is glad to be able to heed the call, even though they're a little bit annoyed at the request that they might make mashed potatoes instead of rice. But the part of the poem that stands out to me isn't the idea that the whole world is an easy touch away and should be, that idea. The part that stands out to me is the bit that describes the child who wears new technology like a second skin. The child is not really separate from technology. Technology is part of who they are. It's nearly a physical part of them, part of their body. And this is the bit that gets me feeling just a little weirded out sometimes. I mean, there's so much technology that is doing so much good for us. In this room right now, I think there's probably a few pacemakers. There's probably, well, I'm thinking of a friend of mine who's diabetic. He doesn't test his blood and give himself injections like he used to. Instead, there's a little machine that's attached to him in a couple of different places, and it monitors his blood sugar levels and lets out a little beep to let him know that something needs to be given some special attention, but otherwise it just kind of gives him the insulin on its own. I have a niece who's deaf in one ear, and at some point there may be wiring that goes right into her brain to help her to compensate for that. So, technology like a second skin. It's awe, I think, that I'm feeling when technology is working this way. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a comfortable feeling of awe. Like standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon, I feel awe at that prospect. I also feel the butterflies in my stomach because it's just so high up. And thinking about technology as a second skin and the way it's sort of integrating itself into our daily lives, into our bodies so often, well, I feel awe, and it's maybe good to take advantage of that just to recognize how complicated that feeling is. Technology is forcing us to confront the question of, well, what does it mean to be really human? How many parts of me could be replaced for me still to be me? How is technology today an aid or a threat to being our human selves? To what extent is technology taking on a life of its own? And what does that mean for our lives? What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be human? Our technology and our tools have always shaped what human life is. We make tools, and then with them, we change how we live and how we think of ourselves. We change how we relate to one another. The New York Times columnist Ezra Klein says that there is no more profound human bias than the expectation that tomorrow will be like today. It is a powerful heuristic tool because it is almost always correct, Klein says. Tomorrow probably will be like today. Next year probably will be like this year. But cast your gaze 10 or 20 years out. Typically, that has been possible to do in human history. I don't think it is now. The pace of change is so fast these days. What Klein is trying to emphasize is how quickly, specifically, artificial intelligence is likely to change what human life is like. He quotes a former member of OpenAI, the group that's behind ChatGPT, and he quotes that leader saying, "The broader intellectual world seems to wildly underestimate how long it will take AI systems to go from large impact on the world to unrecognizably transformed world. This is more likely to be years than decades, and there's a real chance that it's months." Now, that quote is from a column that Klein wrote months ago, so maybe things aren't quite moving at that pace. Hallelujah. But there's no denying that things are changing quickly. There are a lot of reasons why I am wary of artificial intelligence. What with ChatGPT and Google Bard and Microsoft Bing and tons of other chatbots out there. Just do a search for chatbots sometime. You'll get a list of like 50 of the things. I wonder what it means for anyone who is a writer. There are bot-written novels and books by the score on Amazon if you want to buy them. I used to teach writing, and when ChatGPT was launched in November of last year, I can only imagine the game changer that was for writing teachers or for any teacher who was assigning an essay in their class. Oh my goodness. It was released in November, right in the middle of the semester, right? Oh my. One of the main concerns that I and many others have about artificial intelligence is that it just repeats or even reinforces racial and cultural stereotypes. Artificial intelligence systems have to be taught, and that means they have to be loaded up with information. There's a system called COMPASS, C-O-M-P-A-S. It's an acronym for something. And it runs algorithms that predict a defendant's likelihood of recidivism and is used in some courts to determine the sentence that a defendant will receive on their conviction. The nonprofit investigative journalism group ProPublica looked into COMPASS and found that its sentencing assessment was far more likely to assign higher recidivism rates to black defendants than to white defendants. These systems do not target specific races or genders or even take these factors into account, but they often zero in on other information, zip codes, income, previous encounters with police, information that is freighted with historic inequality. These machine-made decisions then end up reinforcing existing social inequalities, creating a feedback loop that makes it even more difficult to transcend our culture's long history of structural racism and human prejudice. And there are lots of other ways that this happens too. Amazon delivery trucks that avoid black neighborhoods, or facial recognition software that has led to unlawful arrests and detainment of black people, and more. AI and technology might not only change us, it might reinforce how we disrespect and dehumanize others. The writer Megan O'Giblin explores the intersection of technology and religion. And while she was looking into these kinds of issues, she came across a piece in Wired magazine, where she now writes an advice column. But this piece in Wired magazine was about a woman who confessed to the sadistic pleasure she got from yelling at Alexa. She called the machine names when it played the wrong radio stations. Sometimes, when the robot misunderstood a question, she and her husband would gang up and berate it together. Then one day, the woman realized that her toddler was watching her unleash this verbal fury. She worried that her behavior toward the robot was affecting her child. Then she considered what it was doing to her own psyche, her own soul, so to speak. What did it mean, she asked, that she had grown inured to casually dehumanizing this thing? What is the relationship we want to have with our robots? Everybody who took out a phone out of their pocket or purse today, you've got a robot with you. All those AI systems, they're robots. We like to refer to them with that little diminutive and call them bots. What is the relationship we want to have with them? I think we need to treat them with some care. We need to come to some understanding of what they are, and that means we need to reflect on who we are and what it means to be human and how we want to live. Megan O'Giblin remarks on how the woman who was yelling abuse at Alexa uses the word dehumanizing to describe what she's been doing to Alexa. When she started out this column, she started out calling it a robot. But then O'Giblin notices somewhere in the process of questioning her treatment of the device, in questioning her own humanity, she had decided, if only subconsciously, to grant it personhood. So is Alexa a person? How do you talk to your GPS when it's trying to give you directions? O'Giblin states that we are constantly, obsessively enchanting the world with life it does not possess. But I don't think I quite share O'Giblin's concern here. She reasons that we enchant the world, treat everything as if it's alive and sentient, because humans have evolved to do this. When we encounter something, see a shadow up ahead, we have to make a guess about what that something is. It might be a boulder, it might be a bear, it might be something else. From a survival standpoint, living things are important to us, important for our survival, but other humans are the most important of all. So when we encounter an uncertain object, it's in our best interest to bet high, guessing that the object is not only alive, but human. And in this way, we, by default, enchant the world. O'Giblin was raised with a conservative Christian theology that she rejected when she was in college, and I wonder if she feels a bit worried about allowing herself to live in an enchanted world, because that's the world she was raised in. God and soul were everywhere, all around. But after rejecting the Calvinist Christianity she grew up with, maybe she feels like she has to let go of that possibility of enchantment too. But what she demonstrates in her book, God, Human, Animal, Machine, is that while scientists and theorists of artificial intelligence tend to be materialists, when they try to explain what they're doing, what they're making, the idea of soul keeps creeping back in. She starts her book by telling the story of how she once got a robot dog, an Aibo made by Sony. Have you heard of these? Yes, okay. She tells of how she started feeling a bit maternalistic towards it, and how she developed an affection for it. It would bark and come to the door to greet her when she came home. It would nuzzle into her hand when she gave it a scratch under its chin. But it was just a robot. After a little while, her husband started getting a little creeped out by it and told her it had to go because it is not real. But you can feel her regret as she describes herself putting Ibo back into his little pod and boxing him up to send him back to Sony. I think defaulting to enchanting the world might be a good thing. One thing I've read many people say about these artificial intelligence systems is that even the people making them don't really have a full understanding of how they work. This is something that makes Ezra Klein worried. We need to be treating these systems with a degree of care and concern that's not clear we're showing right now. I don't necessarily mean that we need to be asking AI systems if it's okay before we use them to do something or instruct them to do something. An engineer at Google, Blake Lemoine, was fired from Google for advocating for that. But confronting these new systems with awe and even a little reverence might be a good thing. Companies and investors are racing and racing along the AI development track. It's not a race that we should be doing just headlong. The MIT professor Sherry Turkle observed in 1984 that in the presence of the computer, people's thoughts turn to their feelings. We cede to the computer the power of reason, but at the same time, in defense, our sense of identity becomes increasingly focused on the soul and the spirit in the human machine. One writer who is a doctoral candidate and focusing on writing about technology and culture calls what Turkle is observing here a romantic reaction. And this writer wonders if we are to make real progress in the question of ethics in technology, perhaps we must revisit the kind of romanticism that Dr. Turkle described. I wonder if the scientists and engineers, as well as the rest of us, if we approach this technology with an openness to awe, might we be better able to appreciate the ways that artificial intelligence might be used and might be abused? I wonder if we approach the technology with a practice of reverence, if it might help us to pause, if only for a moment, to reflect on the ethics and morality we want ourselves and our creations to embody. Because before too long, this technology is going to be for us a second skin.